This is April 30th, 2017, and for Teisho today, I'm going to talk about sitting and moving Zen meditation, Zazen. Before I go any further, just a word to our guests from yesterday's workshop. You probably were told this morning that you can change your posture during this 45-minute talk, Teisho. But just to encourage you to do so, if you feel you need to, what we've learned is that even though we give people permission to everyone, not just workshop people, everyone can change their posture, it turns out that most people sitting in the Zendo, or majority anyway, don't change their posture. And this is apparently intimidating to brand new people who think no one else is moving. I better not be moving, but move if you need to. Most of the people here, I mean virtually everyone has been sitting longer than any workshop person here, and most of us have been sitting long enough that we just prefer not to move. It's a wonderful thing. To just be able to sit still until you need to move. But that's not expected of anyone, certainly not workshop people. So just move when you need to. Just do it as quietly as you can, and everything will be fine. And that leads me right into the topic, moving and not moving in Zen practice. Review as to why in Zen for many centuries the sitting meditation has been very central to Zen practice. To be sure, Zen practice is more than sitting. It's way more than sitting, and there should be no confusion about that. When we talk about Zen meditation, we're talking, yes, about the sitting, but then beyond that, extending that mind of sitting, that mind of meditation into our daily lives. And that means extending the stabilized awareness that we can find in sitting, to extend that into the world of movement, of activity. But without sitting, it's virtually impossible to maintain the same level of stabilized awareness in our daily life as we would with the sitting. Make no mistake about that. Every once in a while, I'll hear someone say, well, you know, I haven't been sitting, but I've been doing a lot of the moving meditation. But I can't buy that. I can't buy that so-called moving meditation is nearly as effective without sitting. So extremely important to make sitting a daily practice. I went into this in a recent Zenbo article. In fact, the current issue that is out, I wrote an article called Finding a Way to Sit Every Day. So I won't go too much into the importance now. I won't repeat too much of how important it is to sit every day, except to say you have to do it. If you're not sitting every day or most days, then you really haven't gotten your practice off of. You're not maintaining your practice, anything like Zen practice. Don't say you're doing Zen practice if you're not sitting almost every day. A little. It doesn't have to be hours, but even a little is better than nothing. I always offer the advice that Roshi Kaplow used to workshop participants, beginners, which is to start modestly. Sit just 15 minutes a day, but try to make it every day. It's that important. There is a passage from Japanese Zen teacher, Nyogen Senzaki, called the first step in Zazen. The piece is by Soyen Shaku, who I think was the first Zen teacher to teach in the United States, and it was way back in the end of the 19th century, 1898 or something like that. There was a World's Fair, something else. But this is him, I think. Soyen Shaku. But let me read it and comment on it. One of my Dharma siblings reads this at the beginning of every sesshin. There's a lot in it. Zazen is not a first let me say, Zazen, strictly speaking, Zazen means sitting. Za means sitting. Zen means meditation. So Zazen, in the narrow sense, means sitting meditation, but we often will use it more broadly as keeping the mind in this stabilized awareness, even in activity, moving Zazen and sitting Zazen. But he says, Zazen is not a difficult task. Just free yourself from all incoming thoughts and hold your mind against them like a great iron wall. Free yourself from all incoming thoughts. So detach from thoughts when you notice them. When you notice that your mind has wandered, just return the attention to the practice you're working on, the breath or the koan, shikantaza. Free yourself from them and hold your mind against them. That would mean hold fast to the breath or the koan like a great iron wall. Now, this important is not saying to try to block out thoughts. That's not real Zazen. We don't want to have anything to do with thoughts. We don't want to traffic in thoughts, but even trying to block them, having this idea of blocking thoughts is also not what we're trying to do. That's still an involvement, a kind of involvement in thoughts. The iron wall is just in the single-minded concentration on the breath or the koan. Think of your own room as the whole world and that all sentient beings are sitting there with you as one. This last sentence has been now realized in a way in the last year or so here at the Rochester Zen Center, in a way that this Soyen Shaku could never have imagined, in our use now of live streaming. Hello, all there are you who are all of you out there who are listening to this live. Thank you for joining us. Think of your own room. Thinking of your own zendo as the whole world, and that all sentient beings are sitting there with you as one, even if you're not listening to live streaming. It could be either Teisho or the sittings themselves. We live stream every sitting. Still, all sentient beings are sitting here with us as one. Realize that your body is not your body. It is a part of the whole body of sentient beings. Your mind is not your mind. It is but a constituent of all mind. Your eyes, your ears, your nose, your tongue, your hands, and your feet are not merely your individual belongings, but one in joint ownership with all sentient beings. You simply call them yours and others. You cling to your own being and consider others separate from you. It is nothing but a baseless delusion of yours. Well, it's probably the most pervasive delusion in the whole world throughout time, is this sense of a separate self. By that, by self, we can understand that as a body-mind complex. It's never just the mind, but the two, body-mind, which are not two. But this is the great affliction of human beings, is thinking that this body-mind is mine, and mine alone, and no others are mine. This identification, this individualized identification. Awakening reveals the illusory nature of that, the false perception behind that. And he repeats, just free yourself from all incoming complications and hold your mind against them like a great iron wall. No matter what sort of contending thoughts arise in you, ignore them, and they will perish and disappear of themselves. And just as soon as your thought expands and unites with the universe, you are free from your stubborn ego. You will then enter into a condition where there is no relativity, no absoluteness. You are now transcendent, far above both discrimination and equality. These discrimination and equality are the two sides of our nature. I won't repeat that anymore, but just that these are the two sides of the coin of reality. The side of say relativity, differentiation, form on the one side, and the other side is the absolute non-discrimination emptiness. You have nothing to receive, and there is nothing to receive you. There is no time, no space. There is no past, no future, but one eternal present. This is the dimension of reality, of experience, that is behind all of our conventional ways of perceiving the world and ourselves. It's sort of the dark side of the moon. When we're not involved in any thoughts in the mind, when we're free of thoughts, then there is no time. There's no past. Where is the past now? The only way we can construe of a past is as a thought, a memory. Otherwise, where is it? Right here. Where's the past? Where's the past? Where's the future? It's just this. This is what in other traditions is referred to as the eternal now. He continues, this is not the true realization, but you are walking near the palace. This is what we would call samadhi, a state of no thought, where the mind is empty, unscored by ideas of time or space, self and other, this and that. But it's not awakening. It's the precondition. You're walking near the palace. Just free yourself from all incoming disturbances and hold your mind against them like a great iron wall. Then someday you will meet you, true self, as if you had awakened from a dream, and will have the happiness you never could have derived otherwise. And then he ends by saying, Zazen is not a difficult task. It is a way to lead you into your long-lost home. When he says Zazen is not a difficult task, he said this, I think, three times. Tell that to a beginner. I remember as a beginner finding it pretty damn difficult, starting with the difficulty of just getting myself to the mat, of doing it every day. This is what I hear so commonly from others, is the difficulty they find in making sitting a part of their daily life. But really, it just comes down to a matter of need. How badly do you need to sit? How badly do you need to come to terms with your own nature, really? And it can begin as a matter of a personal issue. People come to Zen practice struggling with something personal. Sometimes people might begin practice on the heels of a breakup, a divorce, or a breakup in another relationship, or they come because of problems with more generalized anxiety or other emotional problems, depression. Or it can be something more existential. What am I doing here? Where am I going? What do I want to do with my life? Anything that there's just no telling what any one person will find to begin sitting. And sometimes, to be frank, the personal issue, let's say the anguish of a breakup, a divorce or a breakup, sometimes the sitting, when that settles one down, when that enables one to feel more at peace, then there's not enough underlying aspiration of a deeper kind, a more existential kind of aspiration. And so when one begins to feel relief from the circumstance, then one can not feel the same need to practice, and will then drift away until the next loss or other crisis. Then they may remember having acquired some peace of mind through the sitting, and then they may come back to it. People can go in and out of practice this way, where they feel an acute need one way or another, for some reason or another, to sit, and then that abates, and they lose their motivation, but then something else comes along. Of course, the ultimate motivation, the one that will really persist, is a question of life and death. I came across an article from the New York Times. It looks like just from the font. There's no date here. And the title of it is "Why Can't We Sit Still Anymore?" And this is written by a Pamela Paul, the editor of the New York Times Book Review. very well written, and she is pointing to a phenomenon that seems to be quite widespread now, more than ever in the United States. But I'll let her do the talking here. You know that uneasy feeling you get when someone is looming over you? I have it right now, multiplied by four. Only the hoverers aren't doggedly trying to get my attention. They couldn't care less. They're beavering away behind standing desks. In my department alone, four people have installed these towers of productivity in the last month. Plop down in my stationary chair, hands on keyboard, eyes glazed on screen, I, in my turpitude, provide a sad contrast to the action-packed industriousness around me. Everywhere people are standing, walking, and working in double time. Untethered from phone cords and wires, hands are busy with stress balls, O-rings, even executive sandboxes. Between treadmill desks, rolling ball chairs, swinging footrests, and squishy cushions, the idea that a person should sit still seems to have taken a hike. Get up, we are exhorted instead. Climb the stairs, stretch every 10 minutes, stroll around the block. Better yet, stand all day. For reasons ergonomic, exercise-driven, and energy-positive, society's message from the moment a toddler manages an upright position seems to be keep moving, bouncing, and fiddling all the way into adulthood, and, may it never come, in parentheses, old age. Wiggly kids grow up to become college students who tote their tippy stools to the dorm and then storm the workplace with active desks, zipping along an occupational therapy continuum. Perhaps the most surprising thing about this frenzy of dynamism is that screen culture was meant to slow us all down to a sloth-like halt. According to the dystopic vision of Pixar's 2008 film WALL-E, at some point before the iPhone 8, we'd all be reduced to immobilized deposits of screen-stupefied flesh. Instead, sitting has gone from something responsible and orderly to something borderline unseemly. Sitting makes you slump. Sitting makes you fat. Sitting makes you lazy. And she says in parentheses, or are you lazy for even wanting to? Sit down now and, sorry to report, you may never get up. According to urgent studies from the American Medical Association and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, sitting is nothing short of deadly. Forbes' website calls upon readers to, quote, fight sitting disease, and offers a slideshow of six desks to save you from death by sitting. We're gonna get a chance to talk about the other side of this. Time magazine recently warned sitting is sabotaging your health and posted a handy guide to deskercise. Now, I've read some of the articles reporting on research showing that it is healthy to get up every once in a while and move around, walk around your office, your room, and I think there can be no question about that. Just intuitively, we know that at a job that you do, you know, every week of the year practically, it makes sense to get around and move around. And it's interesting that Kinhin, the walking meditation we do between rounds of sitting, has, as far as I know, it's always been part of Zen practice, of not being attached to the sitting posture, but taking a break every once in a while, at least five or 7 minutes, to walk around. When I was at a temple in Japan, Bukokuji, I learned to my surprise that for the evening sittings, the rounds would be 40 minutes, but then between rounds, there'd be 20 minutes where you could do kinin on your own or do kinin in the zendo, full 20 minutes. Some of the residents there would do their laundry during those 20 minutes, or other things. I don't know what they did because I was I would always just go to the temple graveyard and do kinin there for those 20 minutes through the graves. I never stayed back, but I found it even doing the concentrated kinin I was doing during those 20-minute periods, I still found that it really didn't agree with me. It just seemed to break up the rhythm or the momentum of sitting, and I would never want to try that here. I think it's enough to get those 7-minute kinins between rounds. So I think, from what I know, what do I know? I'm not a physician, but I do read, and it does sound like right now there's a lot of evidence that occasionally getting up and moving around is a healthy thing. But she seems to be pointing to how extreme it's become. I'll read more from what her article here. According to the CDC's Take a Stand project, 87% of employees who transitioned to a sit-to-stand workstation said they felt more energized. 66% felt more productive, and 75% felt healthier overall. Switch to a standing position, claims the website for Veridesk, one of many active desk manufacturers, and quote, pretty soon you're energized, focused, free of back pain, and burning calories like crazy, all while getting things done. Is it just me, or does this have a whiff of a fad to it? I think that's what she's saying between the lines. She never comes out and she's just reporting on this phenomenon, but something this extreme, it has to be a fad. How can this... Oh, all right, continue. Standing desks are pervasive enough that their particular fashion requirements are concern enough to merit coverage in the Times Styles section. CEOs are photographed huffing at their treadmill desks as if ready at any moment to take off directly from executive suite to private jet. Bookish types can stand tall like Philip Roth or march ahead like Susan Orlean. With everyone sprinting along, it's hard to remember that sitting down properly was once considered a virtue. According to a new biography of Queen Elizabeth, as a child, the princess was forced to sit for hours on end, unable to go to the loo. If she didn't fidget, she got a cookie. Even plebeian youths were expected to sit while eating, learning, and listening to grown-ups. Monroe Leaf's 1946 children's book, How to Behave and Why, instructed kids on the importance of sitting and standing right, the latter primarily in the execution of greetings and pledges of allegiance. Irritated elders were constantly admonishing one to stay put and stop fussing, terrifying anyone tempted to jiggle a leg into statue-like submission. Today, movie scenes in which children are chastised for freeing an errant pinky in church or refusing to sit through dinner time look as unenlightened as belt lashings. The expectation that children need to move their bodies is so ingrained in contemporary pedagogy that teachers will happily pass out a fidget, a plaything to occupy busy hands, to any student with twitchy fingers. In classrooms, chairs riveted to desks have been replaced with all manner of, quote, active seating, cushions, rocking chairs, rolling balls, wobble stools, both for children with ADHD and for others who simply have trouble staying put. For many children, of course, an issue with nervous regulation, a sensory processing disorder, or simply a passing stage in neurological development can make sitting still a physical challenge, if not an impossibility. And a friendly new vocabulary describes children on the antsy side. Kids aren't hyper or restless or naughty. They are active learners. Physical, very busy. Good behavior isn't about sitting still. It's about, quote, being steady and attending, even if that entails a little wiggle and squirm. I'm reminded as I read this of when I, in what was it, fifth grade, I used to have a nervous habit of drumming my pencil on the desk, and which I became really fully aware of once when apparently I'd been doing it a while, and the teacher was standing before the class teaching, and she finally wheeled on me and said, "Would you stop that?" Luckily, the modern workplace awaits. Ready, set, go for those on the move and shake. And with closed-door offices largely replaced by cubicle dens and shared workspaces, all this capering about is fully endorsed and on full display. Meanwhile, the still and seated may one day become a scorned minority, the 22nd century sidewalk smokers. A throwback to a benighted culture. Cultural doomsayers once feared that people would be hopelessly entranced by the soft glow of the computer screen. Turns out, the real distraction is us. That's the end of the article. And now let's look at the other side. First, one of my favorite quotes from Pascal, the French philosopher, who centuries ago said, "All the unhappiness of men arises from the fact that they cannot sit quietly in their own room." So back to sitting. This sitting still for half an hour, 2 hours, maybe a day, and in Sesshin, of course, longer. Anyone who's done it for very long doesn't need to be convinced of the value of it. By sitting still, we enabled the mind to settle. Again, body, mind. Mind is the immaterial aspect of body. Body is the material aspect of mind. You can't really tease them apart. And that, of course, is why we sit in these postures that you're all sitting in. We're all sitting in here right now in the Zendo. We sit still because it makes it a little easier to keep the mind still, to concentrate the mind. And it's through concentration, that is holding the mind steadily on the practice, it's through concentration that we are able to penetrate into the depths of the mind. This is different. Concentration is different from mindfulness. We hear everything these days about mindfulness, and it's a wonderful thing. We're getting to be a better world by so many people striving to be more mindful. But mindfulness isn't the whole picture. When the Buddha came to his great enlightenment, and then proclaimed the Four Noble Truths. The fourth of those Four Noble Truths is the Noble Eightfold Path, sort of an eightfold way toward liberation. And the seventh and eighth of those methods are right concentration and right mindfulness. So we can make a distinction between concentration and mindfulness. Two different ways of, in a way, you could say it's like flashlight awareness and lantern awareness. The mindfulness is more like the light, awareness light of a lantern. It's just, I don't need to describe it. Picture a lantern and see how the light radiates all around, whereas concentration is a more focused use of attention to the point of one-pointedness in Zen practice. And that concentration is, as I see it, it's about essential as a way to see into the illusory nature of our ordinary consciousness. It's a way to break through. It's a way to come to awakening, this concentration. That's one of the things you never hear about in this wide popularity of what I call generic mindfulness is the promise of awakening. You hear a lot about the other benefits of higher performance at your job, greater effectiveness, and so that you can earn more money, and these kinds of things. And no doubt, they're all true. But I don't hear in this popular generic mindfulness fad anything about awakening for the sake, and also awakening for the sake of other beings, to help others. It's so focused on the self-interest. It's in our self-interest to develop mindfulness. In a Chinese text, came across a reference to a snake entering a tube, and take that to mean the discipline or structure that stills restlessness and confusion. They're referring to Zen practice as offering a snake, when a snake enters a tube. That's how it's like us using this method and getting ourselves straightened out. Another allusion in a Chinese text is like a monkey wearing chains. We have this monkey mind. That's one of the more widely used references to this restless mind of ours, this monkey mind. And one way to tame it is to learn to sit still and concentrate the mind. Not as a way of suppressing our natural, our nature, but of revealing our nature. There's another Japanese Zen master, Takashina, who writes the following: "The true basis of the universe is stillness, its real condition. For out of it comes all activity. The ocean, when the wind ceases, is calm again, as are the trees and grasses. These things return to stillness, their natural way. And this is the principle of Zazen. There is night, there is day. When the sun sets, there is a hush, and then the dead of night, when all is still. This is the meditation of nature." I think this, what I would call obsession with activity, is, if when taken to that extreme that she talks about, is not natural to us. And it may be something unique to the American character. There are two sources that I always go to understand my own people and myself better about Americans. One is the great classic by de Tocqueville. What's it called?
Democracy in America.
Thank you. Democracy in America. And that is a... He took de Tocqueville in the 19th century, did a tour of the United States, and wrote very insightfully about certain American tendencies or the disposition of us Americans. And one of the things he commented on was this restlessness, this ceaseless activity and mobility, moving from one thing to another. I've heard from our European Sangha Dharma brothers and sisters that the number of times that Americans move from one house to another in their lifetime is unheard of in Europe. Not that there's a right or wrong to this. That's not at all what I'm saying. But it's something, it's in terms of self-knowledge. We have certain tendencies, as we do as individuals. And these tendencies are something that are revealed through sitting. We come to know our propensities, our dispositions that are different from other individuals, but then it also works in terms of national tendencies. My wife went to a national conference on attention deficit disorder about, I don't know, 10 years ago. And the keynote speaker, who had made an exhaustive study of this phenomenon, ADHD or ADD, mused, and that's all he could do was just speculate. He mused that as Americans we're genetically loaded for ADHD because our ancestors who emigrated here to the United States were adventurous and impulsive and risk-taking and restless. Those are the ones who came here, by and large. And so that we, possibly, he said, possibly this is why it's largely an American phenomenon, this restlessness and impulsiveness and even violence. No one would dispute that the United States is a more violent country than many others, most others, I would say. This is also another feature of this profile is our impatience. This is one of the traits that Asian teachers find most problematic with American Zen students, and not just Zen, Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist also, is our impatience, our wanting results. We got to do things. We have to achieve things. And also, the Protestant ethic is implicated in this achievement, drive, aspiration. There's a wonderful side to all these things. Wonderful. There's nothing wrong with it, but it does slant us in a certain direction that may be a little out of balance if we don't correct it. So I think sitting is a form of correction to this. When we're sitting, we have a way to stop for a change. Just let the mind settle and get some a deeper perspective on ourselves and our lives and where we're going, instead of ceaselessly grasping, aspiring to be somewhere other than we are. Sitting is a great antidote to that imbalance and to violence itself. There's a wonderful passage by Thomas Merton. It's from a book of his called Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander. And this is what he said. Thomas Merton, maybe not all of you know, Thomas Merton was a monk, was it Franciscan monk?
Trappist.
Thank you. A Trappist monk who took an interest late in his life. He took a keen interest in Buddhism and sort of found in that meditation helped his own spiritual path. And he actually was on his way to a pilgrimage to Asia when he died of electrocution, but when an electric fan, he was in Thailand, just starting on a pilgrimage through Asia, when I think an electric fan fell into the bathtub that he was in and electrocuted him. It's a wonderful kind of a bridge between Christian mysticism and Buddhist mysticism. But this is what he said. There is a pervasive form of contemporary violence to which the idealist most easily succumbs, activism and overwork. The rush and pressure of modern life are a form, perhaps the most common form, of its innate violence. To allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit oneself to too many projects, to want to help everyone and everything, is to succumb to violence. The frenzy of our activism neutralizes our work for peace. It destroys our own inner capacity for peace. It destroys the fruitfulness of our own work because it kills the root of inner wisdom which makes work fruitful. I think there's a great deal of wisdom behind this. And that's another thing we're known for, is overworking, trying to do too much. Do, 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 do. This is our anthem in the United States. And it has enabled us to advance in wonderful ways, achieve a lot, but it has this dark side to it. And that's where the sitting, the stopping, brings balance and wholeness to our lives. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. Beings without number,
I bow to the great endless blind passions. I bow to uproot arm against beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to the great endless blind passion. I bow to the root dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to the great endless life. bow to attend.
We'll do standing bows.